the topic is Science About God. Now that's the catchy title. The subtext is simply a discussion about the relationship of two ways of knowing, two ways of investigating, namely science and theology, between whom there has been long, sometimes debate, sometimes cooperation, sometimes conflict. Let me start with a few brief comments about forums at Holden Village. The purpose of forums is conversation, mutual instruction. Earlier in the summer, Karen Bloomquist was here talking about the church as a community of moral deliberation. I'm not sure that this is really a moral question that we're facing tonight, but definitely it's one about which conversation is appropriate. We don't intend to come to any kind of decision. We will not, at the end of this, vote, is science about God, and issue some kind of public statement to the world. But so that really the purpose is ongoing consideration. Secondly, something about the mode. And here again, conversation is the key word. Conversation of mutual respect. Certainly you're encouraged to respond to each other, to ask for clarification, to disagree. But we ask that you do that with regard for others and others' views and feelings. This is not a debate, despite what the suddenly appearing words on the board there would suggest. And then finally, forums go until 10 o'clock. We stop at 10 o'clock because the sorts of things that we take up in forums will not be finished even if we stay another 5 minutes. Or 10 minutes, or 15 minutes. Rather, I always think of forums at Holden Village as the beginning of a conversation that goes on later, in the evening, tomorrow morning at breakfast, on the trail, wherever it is that you continue to converse with people about these topics. Our format tonight is a little bit different. Frequently we have people addressing the same question. Tonight we have two different strategies here. Rick Dunning, who's the curator of the Porto Museum and a professor of geography, will be giving us a brief historical survey of the interactions between science and religion. And then Mike Pellet on the far end, who's a professor of theology, and Glenn Matheson, who is a staff scientist at Los Alamos, will be addressing from their respective positions questions about the problems, possibilities, and challenges that their perspective offers to the other one. So we'll start with Rick and then move to the other two.
Okay, good evening. Couple things to keep in mind as we're talking about this. One would be the summer theme, image of God, and ways that we construct our images of God, ways that we know God. We can consider the compatibility of a scientific viewpoint and a theological viewpoint for how we build our image of God. The other thing to keep in mind is that this is the Science and Technology Emphasis Week. This is a culmination of that week, perhaps. And here at the close of the week, the Science and Technology Committee is meeting to talk about some of the issues that face the village over the next few years to the next decade or so. And in some ways, perhaps the conversation can shape a little bit our thinking about longer range sorts of activities that this committee might get itself involved in. As Deanne mentioned, I'm going to try and, in a few minutes, rough out a quick sketch of one way to think about the relationship between theology and science. It's hard to take 2,000 years of intellectual history and compress it into a few minutes, but as I say, it will just be a sketch and more of a way of thinking about how this relationship has changed through time. And I'll
sketch a few things. See that there?
Of course, for someone who usually works in millions of years, this should be an easy task.
Easy task.
I would like to suggest that we let the black represent science and the green represent theology, that the two started out together and gradually diverged in terms of the way that they related to each other. And we don't have to go too far back. We could start kind of post-Renaissance, 16th century, 15th, 16th century. One way to think about science was that, at least initially, the early scientists did not see themselves as doing something distinct from, or terribly distinct from theology, at least not all of them necessarily. That in effect, the study of science was a study about God, a study of theology. And we could talk then about natural theology. And the general idea that you know something about the Creator by studying the creation. And so in effect, the early scientists were in some cases thinking they were doing the job of theologians, learning about God by studying the creation. And that many of the things that were written and studied by some of the early scientists, at least, were done in the context of their faith and in the context of their understanding of themselves as Christian theologians, often trained as theologians. But we do observe a gradual divergence of the two ways of thinking and knowing. You often hear the 17th century described as the time of this scientific revolution. That's a little difficult to pin down. For one thing, this scientific revolution is a long, long process, not an event. So you can't really say it happened then. Many of the divergent paths started prior to the 17th century. Copernicus and his notion that the sun was the center of the solar system and not the earth was a major step in that divergence, undermining previous notions of Earth as center of solar system. By the 17th century, Bacon and Descartes and Galileo and Newton eventually were at the forefront of the scientific method and experimentation. And in the 17th century, we see the gradual emergence, or at least the beginnings of a scientific way of asking questions, the scientific method beginning about then. But really, even in this 17th century scientific revolution, there was not a lot of divergence between the two ways of thinking. And throughout this time, many of the people who called themselves scientists still, in many cases, saw themselves as doing natural theology. One quote I read suggested, presenting evidence of God by showing the wisdom and power of creation. That was the job of science, to prove God, in a sense, by the intricacies of the creation, or to provide something of what we know about God. Gradually we see an increasing divergence of the two paths through the 18th century and into the 19th century. And in effect, people have often presented religion, theology, and science as in opposition to each other. That, in a sense, the theologians saw the scientists as enemies. At least that's how it was described sometimes. that the scientists were trying to, the things, the questions the scientists were trying to ask and the conclusions they came up with seemed to counteract or contradict scriptures. And in a sense, science was doing more to undermine religious convictions than to support them. And science, in developing its scientific method, prizing itself on objective knowledge, on experimentation as a way of achieving that knowledge, objectivity, in a sense, regarded religion as being non-scientific, being subjective, being value-laden, and exactly the opposite of which of what either of them wanted to accomplish. In a sense, they continued to diverge right up through modern time, with always some connections between them. But in a sense, they both were led on pathways that had incomplete conclusions, that left them a little bit empty. In a sense, just sticking with the theological pathway, some might suggest that the end result of that was a view of the world which was spiritual, which was more concerned with individual salvation, with apocalyptic views of the world, end times, of no concern for the earth, only concern for spiritual matters. And that with the scientific pathway, and we might kind of diverge off of the scientific pathway as sort of a separate path for technology, beginning about the Industrial Revolution and going on, science and technology diverged a little bit. They had different aims. But the net result of the pathway of science seemed to be a technological or scientific society. We can talk about the effects of this technology and the science in terms of environmental destruction, this industrial capitalist technocratic society, the effect on social relationships, that in a sense both pathways were kind of empty if you only stuck with that pathway and followed the diverging direction to its logical conclusion. Again, it's all been a long involved process, and in the midst of all of this, we need to keep in mind all of the social, cultural, political, economic changes that have taken place in the world during this time, that it happens within a broader context. But I would like to suggest that in some ways, we find now both scientists and theologians kind of looking back over their shoulder at what the other folks are doing. And in a sense, maybe at least some beginning to consider some of the ways where we might see some convergence again, looking for ways to kind of get back together. And I would suggest a couple of possibilities that might bear this out. Among the theologians, we see looking to science for concepts about the world. I'm thinking specifically about ecological understanding of the world as interrelated, a holistic understanding of the world that comes not so much from our scriptural interpretations, but our scientific, biological, geological understanding of how the whole world works. And as religious people look back at that, they see a new way to interpret the creation, and many are embracing that sort of ecological approach. Many are looking at things like chaos theory and quantum physics, and seeing some of the kinds of questions scientists are asking about larger relationships and ultimate beginnings of matter And in some ways, seeing in the kinds of questions scientists ask some interesting things about our own concept of the world. And on the other side, I would suggest that the scientists and the technicians are maybe looking back to the theologians for some moral basis for decision making. For, science is good at laying out choices and the implications of choices, but when it comes down to choice, to making the choices, sometimes that's more often a moral decision than a simple evaluation of evidence. And science doesn't always provide that. So the kind of question we're coming up with in our forum title is, what has science to say to the theologians? And what have the theologians to say to the scientists? Is there some way that they affect and inform each other? And ultimately, we could ask the question, is there such a thing as a Christian scientist or a scientific Christian? is that an oxymoron? And also, one thing I would wonder about a little bit is, in this looking back toward each other, are we going back to natural theology again? I know that in some of my reading of writings in contemporary creation spirituality or nature spirituality, that in a sense, people are calling for a return to looking at nature to understand our right relationship with God or our right relationship with the rest of creation. And some of the questions we see being asked by religious peoples today certainly sound a little bit like natural theology. And I would ask, is this really happening? What might be the implications of that? What might be the dangers of this sort of natural theology approach? And I guess those centuries took a little longer than I thought. But this is, in terms of your thinking about what we're asking, kind of put it in this historical context a little bit. And then I would ask Glenn and then Mike to kind of sharpen the questions a little bit.
Well, Glenn.
You want me to start?
It sounds like it. We'll go in reverse chronological order of development.
The question is actually very difficult even gather in the time that I've had all of the implications that I can think of. So I'm not going to be able to give a very complete picture. I can give you maybe a few snapshots of some of the things that I've thought about since I got the title to this forum. First of all, the scientific method is like an axiom. That is, those of you that are familiar with mathematics, it's a way of using a criteria, that is, that a point exists, and if I have a point here and a point here, I can draw a line to those two points. And they're developed from that Euclidean geometry. The scientific method is like that. It was developed as a way of looking at nature, and from that process, we learned a great deal. That is, the scientific method is one in which you understand something by being able to isolate it. That is, you do an experiment that's reproducible. It's isolated. If you go outside and take a rock and stand out in the middle of the road and hold it up and drop it, you repeat the process. It happens the same way every time. It always falls to the earth. And so as a result of that idea, and keep in mind, it's an idea, we've learned a great deal about certain ways in which the earth is made, certain, I'd call them, we call them laws in science. We call law of gravity, electromagnetism, nuclear forces, all kinds of things of that nature that have been discovered as a result of that scientific method. Now, that does exclude experiences that I've had, and I'm probably most of you have had, that somehow don't seem to fit in this particular situation. And that's a problem. You know, how do those exclusions, for example, if you have an experience where you know something's happened, and you're not anywhere near there, but you know it's happened, and later on you find out, yes, indeed, it happened exactly when you thought it happened and everything else. There are things of that kind that aren't a part of the scientific method. I'm aware of that, a lot of people that are aware of that. And so, to me, what does that say? It says, as you would guess, that there's something missing in the method. So that's another, again, these are just snapshots of a scientist looking at reality. When I think of my faith, you know, faith, if I try to think about science as somehow helping me discover God, no. My faith doesn't come from science. My faith comes from God. Now, if I ask a different question, in the reality of that faith, how do I see science? That's different. I mean, in the talk I gave on energy ethics, I gave a bunch of images of God, which I would hope that you would go to, because those images are both very personal from my experience that I've had with people. But there's also other images that come from my work as a scientist. One of them is a God who created this incredible tuning fork, which is so complex that it's incredible. I mean, you hit the fork and you get that sound. Here we have the sun and the earth and this balance that goes on between the sun and the earth, where the sun is giving the earth energy, and the energy goes into plant life and human life and animal life. And we have this whole business that is put in motion, that has been going on for many, many, many years. But it's a delicate system, as we're finding out. And if you hit it, you know, you do something, you can upset it. You know, Darwin found out that there's a particular process of regeneration that occurs, and it depends on what happens, the environment and everything else. And so, what do I see this part of God, this part of God as a creator of the atom, a creator of humans, a creator of butterflies, creator of the sun and energy and light. And in that, all of these laws that we call that make things function the way they do, law of gravity, the nuclear forces. And you can ask yourself, well, what would happen if the law was somewhat different, that God you know, change the electromagnetic force. And I thought about that. What would happen? Or what would happen if our sight wasn't the way it was, but we saw things in infrared? So you see this incredible diversity of possibility. And so you see the magnitude of God. I mean, this is a small part of it. I mean, you have the universe then too. You have black holes and situations where, like, I mean, just looking at the sun, if any of you saw a picture of the solar eclipse, how many of you did? In the picture that you saw, you may have seen looked like some kind of flame on the top. It's called a prominence. If you took a pin and just touched that prominence, that'd be the size of the Earth. Huge, huge thing. And so those are some of the things that science brings to my image of God. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Mike?
I too want to give a little historical overview from a theological point of view, almost a somewhat a tongue-in-cheek point of view, to say why is there so many problems between science and theology? Well, it's all theology's fault, and then the scientists believe it, and now what do you do? And that is to somewhat go back for which for most parts has been kind of the Christian understanding, particularly popularized by Augustine, in terms of the relationship between, if you will, God's history and our history, or human history. Okay? And let's just say that this line here is human history. Augustine and others within the church would say, and God's history is up here, but every now and then God comes, and my way of talking about this is either the Blitzkrieg or EKG theory of history, where God comes along and boom, is revealed or intersects with human history. So we have God coming to Abraham and Sarah, and then boom, he comes again with Moses and the Exodus. And boom, we come again with David, and boom, Solomon and the prophets, and boom, significantly with Christ, and so on and so forth. And every point there's this intersection between God's history and our history. Augustine and later, and those of us in the church today, continue to call that salvation history. And that's what's really important, and that's what counts, because that's where God and humanity are involved. And that's okay, except you say, well, what happens in between here? Isn't God involved in history here? Oh, well, yeah, that's creation, and, God made it, but it doesn't count. So what is that area that doesn't count too much? Well, we'll call that natural theology, because somehow we have to put it in there. But often, to radicalize this as much as possible, natural theology was basically kind of an atheism, because, at least from the Christian perspective, we didn't talk anything at all about what God was doing in there. I mean, so in other words, politics, well, let the politics, you know, God has nothing to do with that. You know, culture, well, let, you know, all of that stuff is not there. Now, again, there would be a few Christian thinkers who would not totally buy this, but would want to keep these two things together. And the greatest of those thinkers, I would claim, is Thomas Aquinas. And Thomas would say that all things coming from God and God being God means that all things are true. Now, how does God enable truth to happen? Well, God enables truth to happen through revelation, And that's what this blitzkrieg is all about, because that is God's revelation to Abraham and Sarah and the Moses and the Exodus and David and the prophets and Christ. But Thomas says, God also is at work in the world vis-a-vis creation reasonably. And so part of Thomas's entire theological problem by ourselves to come to that absolute truth. And Thomas would say, well, you know, look at the greatest thinkers around, Plato, and of course for Thomas, Aristotle, devoted their entire lives to this searching and seeking for truth vis-a-vis reason. And they just began to scratch the surface. So God says, well, if I'm going to wait for human beings to figure out what's true, you know, talk about geological time, right? So what? Well, we're going to help them out. Revelation. Boom. So now we know what's true. And now the task of theology is to show the compatibility of these. Even so, the basic theological task, and again, the Reformation, Luther, Calvin, and others, quite frankly, don't help us that much, because they, again, adapt Augustine's model of salvation history. And again, it's these little points of intersection that are important. After the Reformation, and now here's where all the things that Rick says come in, and I don't disagree with him at all there. At that point, and with the Enlightenment and that kind of thinking, philosophers, scientists are saying, well, what about these gaps? Don't they count for something? So on and so forth. And they say, well, if theology isn't important or isn't interested in that, we'll pick it up. This is what really counts. And so scientific method looks at that. Philosophy shift looks at the human being and reason, and what is reason, and why is a human being reasonable, and what does that all mean? And so we get folks like Descartes and Locke and Hume and Kant, and we can go through the whole litany of philosophers at this time. And as well, there is developed a new kind of historical consciousness that says that instead of having an absolute immutable truth that always remains constant through all time, we recognize that truth is seen as true within its particular historical context. And, you know, the scientists help us to see that. I mean, right? The Ptolemaic system over against the Copernican system. What is true for many centuries no longer is quote-unquote true. There's another understanding of truth. And so that context and all comes in, which again begins to challenge some of this salvation history understandings too for the context. When it begins to challenge some of that, right, then now there becomes that, we'll put it this way, that kind of challenge that some see as faith, as that between faith and science. And some put that challenge as faith versus science. And so for 200 to 300 years, there are some within theology because of this view, and others within science who basically think that only what's between the gaps is important. Obviously, they see the relationship between faith and science as antagonistic. So it's faith versus science. But I think we may be getting older and no wiser, and here are the kinds of things that Glenn has said come in. We've had a chance to look at that a bit and say, there does not have to be incompatibility between faith and science, because even though we might be looking at the same thing, we're looking at it differently, and we are asking different questions. So of course we're going to get different answers, but that doesn't mean, again, that it's contradictory. And as Glenn has said very well, right, the scientific method is a particular way of looking at things. It has its criteria, we'll make it plural, and therefore it also means that it has its limitations. I mean, the scientific method is in, and I don't mean this in any sense pejoratively, a reductionist method. because it asserts certain formulas and says, well, the best way that we can study phenomena is empirically, through observation. We try to mathematicize it, formulas, so on and so forth. And that's how we begin to explain what things are all about. And so you have the particular theories or laws that do that. Well, in theology, we say, but yeah, there are certain other experiences or maybe even the same phenomenon that you look at. But we want to look at that in terms of meaning and understanding and relationship. And it's very difficult to mathematicize a relationship. I'm not quite sure how I would mathematicize my marriage. I'm not quite sure how I would mathematicize my relationship of faith between myself and God. Now, there has been there have been attempts. I mean, Leibniz, in developing the calculus, basically did that as theology to try to show the harmonious understanding of all things, and he couldn't find any language suitable, so he had to come up with his own, the calculus. But other than that kind of attempt by Leibniz, we recognize again, we're asking different questions. We'll see different answers. We recognize that distinction. And so certainly faith and science are distinct in their enterprises. But that does not mean antithetical, or certainly scientists are very good Christians. No contradiction at that point. And so I think at that, where we're at now, and here we go back. One more thing, just to kind of toss that out. Well, what does this mean with regard to natural theology? Well, at least from the theological point of view, I would say, let's not go back to natural theology. That's not particularly helpful in our enterprise. And if we want to kind of figure out and understand the world in terms of explaining how it quote-unquote works, let's let the scientists do their thing.
I got a comment on your God line and the human line. And you could look at the difference, sort of what you call dead period, in between as an incubation period for the Einstein blips that you get along the way.
Are you suggesting that Einstein is a moment of revelation?
Not necessarily, just the fact that he was an immense mind. Williams.
It's that, Mark, but it's also a timing. That's very important. Einstein was living during a period of time when there were a lot of things coming together. Okay, so it's not only the mind; it's when it occurs.
Yeah,
that's very.
That's
important.
Why I used Einstein in there because.
Yeah.
Guess so. That human history, where God's history joins, what's the date that we know of the last possible time that this happened? What's the last one?
I'm only moderating, Mike. Don't look at me. Moderator is neutral and objective. Only helps the process. But I'm stalling to give you a chance to decide what to say.
No, I'm just trying to give a succinct, less than 3-hour answer. It depends. To whom you speak on that, and how they understand that. For example, let's say many would say that the last blip that God came in here is with the writing of the last book of the New Testament, and since then there has been no drop down again. Others would, and this is particularly the Roman Catholic Church, would want to make the claim that this blip keeps coming down whenever there has been an ecumenical council or the Pope has spoken to give us a dogma. And whenever there is a dogma, we once again have God's action within human history. So at that point, there, the last time that would have happened is in the early 50s when the church passed their dogma on the Assumption of Mary, namely that Mary was taken bodily, physically, up into heaven. She was assumed. So that would have been the last time. Right. Now the other thing, and this is why it's going to get complicated in that, is since the Reformation and others, and particularly within much of contemporary theology today, and myself included, we no longer buy that model of understanding the interaction between God's history and human history. But we want to put those two lines together and say that, you know, the story of humans and God in history is all on one line with, and we can note events and so on and so forth. So that's the other way to respond to that. But I wanted to use this and say this because it has been this kind of understanding from the Christian theological point of view that has set the historical context of why within the last 200 or 300 years there has been able to arise this kind of faith versus science antagonism.
I guess I would make a comment about that. One of the things that I was thinking about is I think it's important not to forget your own role. I mean, you look at particular points that are crossing this diagram, and you think of a particular important event that people have decided was an important event. But when I heard Michael talking there, what came through my mind is that I guess I would say that each of your lives is the movement of God. And don't underestimate that. I think one of the things I was reminded of is that God works through us. He works through anybody he wants. Whether he's a Christian or not either. But each of you is in that. I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but if you're watching a river, you watch the river flow and go over the rocks and do its kind of thing. The human movement, I think, is like that too. God's not out of control, and we're part of that movement, a very integral part of it, because he's told us that. And so you're a part of this line. You're part of, I think, you're a bump. So you're a blip there. And so I just want to remind you that. I think that's the gospel.
Could you go back to the beginning for a minute? Can anybody imagine what this would be today, if there would be a today, if Eve had been a little shorter?
One of my former colleagues told about when he was doing internship working with preschool kids, and they'd just done the creation and fall stories, and one child drew a picture of a very tall apple tree with the apple high up, and there were two figures, one standing on the other's shoulder.
There certainly wouldn't be any need for the discussion tonight. There wouldn't be any science.
Why is that? Huh? Why do you think that?
Why? Because there would be no vision of knowledge. You wouldn't need it.
So we need science because we're sinful?
Oh, no.
Is that what
it is? No. We need science because I'm hungry.
Yes, but so were Adam and Eve.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, no, at that point, you see, and that's why I'm not going to.
This is terrible. I'm defending science here.
I'm not going to bash science in any way, shape, or form because I understand science to be part of what God has created. Where did that happen? Well, Genesis 2 is the easiest, that God forms the human being, puts that human being, Adam, in a garden and says what? Till and keep it. Well, one of the things I would want to say, what is till and keeping a garden all about? Well, we need a little science about, well, how do you till and keep gardens? That sounds pretty scientific to me in that sense. Yeah, I mean, there's a way of knowing how you till and keep a garden. So, I mean, in that sense, science and all of that kind of pursuit is part of God's good creation, not antithetical at all to the relationship which God has established between human beings.
I think that another thing that I'd like to mention, in a sense, we're in a wonderful time as humans, in a very difficult time at the same time. And what do I mean by that? I mean that we're in a position where we have to make evaluations that our ancestors didn't have to do. For example, I guess easiest with examples, one of the things that you may have to do is, there's a number of older people here, you may have to in the future decide whether or not your spouse should continue to live or die. You know, it wasn't possible before. For the younger people, although there's a few young people here, if you have you want to have a child, and you can have it tested, and maybe the child has Down syndrome, then you have a decision to make. If you find that out, do you have the child killed? Or is the child to live? Genetics is going to bring to the fore questions about changing genes for people to possibly go a particular direction with size and weight. And there's all kinds of decisions like that. In addition to the closeness that our environment, that is one of the visions that I have that I'll share with you, is that I don't see that a United States is going to be a very meaningful, certainly not in the sense that it has been in the fact in the past, that is, as a separate nation that can somehow separate itself from the rest of the world. I think that in the near future, that in fact we'll have to think about things from not only a North America standpoint, but from a global standpoint. And so our relationships with other nations are going to be very different. The whole way that we do things is going to be much more, I hope, it can go two directions. My hope is that it's much more united. Okay? But it doesn't necessarily have to be like that. It could be one in which it's very destructive. So, you know, God has done incredible things, and I keep wondering, you wonder how God, how is he doing things? I mean, that's one of the things that a scientist asks everyone. How is he doing this? I mean, does he just kind of set it in motion and things evolve? And yeah, we have our free will, but he still, you know, he still knows how things are going to turn out somehow. And it's that's something that you can do. I'm sure many of you have done that and said, oh yeah, here I am playing God again, trying to figure out what God's doing. But it's wonderful. I mean, all the things that are happening, because we have decisions now that are incredible decisions.
There's an Eskimo story of a family where they were on a, I can't say safari, that's hardly where you'd have a safari, but on moving from one place to another in the ice and snow, and we're getting low on food, and Grandma decided to sit it out. So she sat down, nobody looked back, but she had decided for the survival of the family that she would remove herself from the picture.
See, there's one thing I didn't comment on, and let me do that. I have, but I don't think you would understand it. I didn't really comment on theology as such, you know, directly. But I hope one of the things that you realize is that pretty much everything I've said is related to theology. When I'm in a position for making a decision, typically it requires, if it's an important decision, to go back to the Gospels as a reference point. And as an example of the decision process that Christ went through. And that's very much a part of my life. I can't really separate the scientific part of me, and even if it is separate, you know, I'm not sure that that's true. I can't separate all of those things that are a part of me, the science and the faith and the relationships and other things that go on. But that's the reference that is always in the background.
Are there others who have questions they'd like to raise? Roxy?
Yeah, that when you said play God, that's an expression I've used for years for planners who think that the land needs to be developed and they bulldoze it clean and then they develop it. I mean, that's the difference between raw land and cooked land. Not an original finding, but a friend of mine said that. But that's what we see everywhere. And I just don't understand how we can separate it. I mean, you don't want to get back to a naturalist sort of thing, but we live in the world. You know, and we can look at it from a scientific point of view, and we can say, okay, that's really what's going on right here. That's what we think is going on right here. And yet, we can't handle this stuff. We aren't handling it. We're making a big mess. One of the biggest messes we have is right down there in Hanford. And now we're trying to figure out how to clean up our mess. You can't clean it up. And so, you know, shouldn't there be some way to look at this stuff and not make such big messes?
Sure. And I think that, I mean, I would disagree with you about the biggest mess. The biggest mess.
No, I said it's a big mess.
Yeah, it's a big mess.
But
it's not the biggest mess.
I agree with you. It's not the biggest one. It's not the biggest one.
What is the biggest one?
Oh, there's many.
The biggest one is out of
Mark, do you know about this is so big we can't know about it?
Do you know some secret messes?
No, there's, I talked about that. The risk associated with all the different energy sources we have. There's a lot of messiness, global messiness, not just isolated messiness.
Yeah, but just our desire for all this energy. What do we need it all for? To make more messes with. It's what we use a lot of our energy for.
Yes and no.
Well, aluminum cans in the Pacific Northwest is the first example I'm thinking of.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, it would take a long time to develop this.
And we're running out of it.
Uh-oh. Right. I think that what you need to do is, you should have come to my class is what you should have done.
There's a tape. This is an excellent opportunity for a little commercial about tape ministry.
The energy.
But that would give you, that would really answer the questions, okay, that are associated with how we make our mess. But to say that somehow you're just going to get rid of it. I mean, we have never been rid of it. I mean, one of the problems that we have now is the fact that we have a lot more people. And so when somebody dumps something, I mean, there's all kinds of people that dump it now, so you see it. It's always been going on. The mess has always been there. And so the fact that you have a growing population, the fact that the globe is getting smaller, helps you to see the messiness that's been going on ever since humans have been on the planet. And the energy, one of the things that has happened for us in terms of the technology is that we've been freed from a lot of, believe it or not, a lot of the pollution that my parents had. My parents lived in Kamano Island and they had wood stoves and it was an incredibly polluted environment there. Anyway, but that's a different thing. I think that requires another forum, two forums.
Well, I was thinking in terms of the way we look at why we need it.
Sure.
Yeah. And I don't see why that can't be a theological look.
Well, this is always what happens with forums, that we come to the end with new questions. And it does seem to me that we have sort of circled to some other questions about not is science about God, but what do both science and theology contribute not only to how we get ourselves into a mess, but how we respond to where we find ourselves, so that we don't just ask, how has the conflict between science and faith gotten us in trouble, but what can each contribute to our ongoing life together? So I thank you, and I...